Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. It might be a little rainy and chilly here for spring in New York, but nevertheless, it's a beautiful Thursday morning because here I am with all of you, and I'm really happy to share with you what's going on in around the New York area, what's going on in the news, what you can do to make a difference. And I also have a wonderful guest on today, Tim West. He is recognized as one of Zagat's 30 under 30, meaning one of the up-and-coming chefs to be watching. He's a social entrepreneur, and I can't wait to introduce him to you later in the show, after, of course, I share a recipe with you. So first, if you live in Long Island, it is Restaurant Week. So now through May 4th is Restaurant Week, so take advantage of that. And remember, one of the things that I'm really trying to encourage everybody to do, when you go out to eat, no matter what kind of restaurant you're at, ask the waiter or waitress about the food you're getting. Ask if the fish is sustainably harvested or wild caught. Ask if it's local. If you're getting meat or chicken, is it raised without hormones and antibiotics? Is it raised in a sustainable way? Is it from a factory farm or is it local? All these are questions you want to know. You want to know if the foods they serve contain genetically modified ingredients. The more we all ask and demand restaurateurs to have some transparency in their foods, the quicker our food system will change. Tonight, there is a showing at the South Huntington Public Library on Long Island about, it's called Take Back Your Power, and it's about the dangers of the smart meter. And this is a new one for me. I don't even know much about it, so I'm hoping to go tonight. The smart meter, my understanding is it is something that they put on your home to monitor gas, electric, all kinds of utilities, but they, at the same time, it is transmitting more radioactive waves into your home. So this is something new that is going to be coming out and attached to all of our homes, so you do want to know about it. So if you can't make it to the movie, see if you can find the movie somewhere else, Take Back Your Power, or just search the internet for a smart meter and find out about that so that we can all stay informed. Saturday, May 3rd, there is a optimal health and wellness event here on Long Island at the Marriott Residence. Dr. Bryant Clement, the co-director of the Hippocrates Institute, will be there, as well as Marla Friedman, a new author of a book called Love, Freedom, and Wellness. Thursday, there's a very important GMO labeling action in front of Assemblywoman Michael Solages of Nassau County. And we want to let her know that we care about the foods we eat, and we want transparency, and we want her to support the GMO labeling law. Right now she is not, and we need to convince her to change her stance. So if you can come out to that, information is on my website at ieatgreen.com. May 10th, Riverkeeper Sweep, clean up the Hudson River. Participate in that would be wonderful. You can find out more information at the Riverkeeper website. Edible Communities is having an Edible Institute in New York. This is should be really great, May 10th and 11th. It's at the New School in Manhattan, and there's going to be a whole lineup of speakers and events and tastings and walking tours from Brooklyn rooftop gardens to trips up to the Hudson Valley. So it should be a really great weekend. You can sign up for that. May 13th, Michael Pollan is speaking up at the 92nd Street Y. That should be great. May 17th, Run Fast for Slow Food New York City. Slow Food, as you know, is an organization very dear to my heart. It's about good, clean, and fair food. And when I talk to you about going out to a restaurant, asking the restaurateur whether your food is locally sourced, organic, contains GMOs, all that are the kind of questions that Slow Food is really trying to promote awareness about. So go onto the Slow Food New York City website to find out about this run. Fundraiser. There's a march against Monsanto everywhere, May 24th. This is a really big happening. Millions of people took part in it last year. Again, it's March 24th, so find an event near you. You just can go on to just search the web, March Against Monsanto, and you'll find out about marches all across the country, and you can find one near you. May 29th, Brooklyn Uncorked is also being sponsored by the Edible Communities, and you can find out more information about that. May 28th, I am hosting, along with someone from Morgan Stanley, a socially responsible investing dinner. And the reason I'm hosting this is because I know that I have had a really tough time trying to find out information about where I have my stocks invested and, you know, how I can make responsible choices and divest from any companies that have anything to do with fossil fuel or biotech companies having to do with GMOs. And it's really a challenge. And so I've been working with a group at Morgan Stanley to only invest in socially responsible companies, and they've been really doing great by me. So I wanted to share that information with anyone out there. It is a free farm-to-table dinner at a private home in Lloyd Harbor. So if you are interested, please send me an email at bhavani@iegreen.com. And June 5th is Slow Food New York City's third annual fundraiser. And that should be a really great event also, and you can find out more information about that at the Slow Food New York City's website. Okay, things that are going on in and around the news. You know, this past weekend there was a great, great rally down in Washington, D.C. on the Mall. It was a march against the Keystone XL pipeline, and as many of you know, that is the rally I was participating in when I got arrested a couple years ago down in Washington, D.C., and standing up against the expansion of the Keystone Pipeline is a really important thing. People have said that the Keystone Pipeline, if that goes forward, that is like the end of our planet. I mean, it's just a really, really bad thing. It will contaminate over 5 million people's worth of water. It will contaminate the aquifers that we water our plants with, and so it will affect all of our agriculture that feeds most of this country. So find out about the Keystone XL pipeline, and when you can, please stand up against it. It's really, really important. Also, we depend a lot on the Organic Standards Board. The National Organic Standards Board is an organization that was set up over 20 years ago to protect our organic industry. However, as more and more giant corporate companies have been buying up organic companies, of course, big corporation is now infiltrating this Organic Standards Board, and that revolving door that you hear about with the FDA and the USDA and all these different departments, well, here it is also going on in the National Organic Standards Board. And, you know, they are really pushing to try to allow different synthetic ingredients into the organic food system. So we really need to take action, let our officials know that we want to protect the Organic Standards Board from that kind of corruption. So there is a petition on my website for you to sign, and I really encourage all of you to do that. There's also a petition there to support better nutrition and physical activity in schools, and there is also a petition to sign to encourage Michelle Obama to support the Saving America's Pollinator Act. And as you all know about the bee colony collapse disorder, it's really, you know, these neocotinoids that are a pesticide that are really destroying our bee colonies. And our country is not doing anything about it. The European Union has already placed a 2-year moratorium on these neocotinoids, and we have not. So there's a petition on my website to please ask Michelle Obama to set the standard. They now have a beehive on the Washington White House Mall area, right actually on the lawn itself at the garden. And so they planted a whole pollinator garden for their bees, and we really want you to encourage Michelle Obama to support the passing of the Saving America's Pollinator Act. So please participate in that. I want to share with you a recipe before I introduce Tim West to all of you. This recipe that I made was a stuffed acorn squash. The acorn squashes are still, you know, around. They are one of the root vegetables that, actually it's not a root vegetable, but it's one of the great vegetables that lasts over the winter and can be really stored for a long time. So you still can find some really great acorn squash out there. And I stuffed it, and I want to share that with you. So I used 5 acorn squashes that I cut in half. I removed the seeds, and then one side had that big nub on it, so I had to cut that off so that all the halves would lay down evenly in the pan and not wobble. So I cut the ends of those off. Then I used 1 onion I chopped, 2 carrots diced, 2 parsnips diced, 6 ounces of shiitake mushrooms sliced, 2 stalks of celery chopped, 1/2 teaspoon of Chinese 5-spice, 1 zucchini diced, 1 yellow summer squash diced, 2 cups of broccoli cut into small florets, 1/2 cauliflower cut into small florets, 1 can of cannelloni beans, 1 tablespoon chopped sage, 1 tablespoon minced garlic, 1 tablespoon minced ginger, 1/4 cup of good-tasting nutritional yeast. That is not brewer's yeast. It's different than brewer's yeast, and it's a great powder form. It comes in flake powder form that you can use to make wonderful, flavorful sauces. 1/4 cup of water, 1 cup of chopped assorted peppers, 1 bunch of asparagus cut on the diagonal into 1-inch pieces, olive oil, 1 tablespoon tamari, 1 tablespoon aji marin, 1/3 cup of toasted slivered almonds, 2 cups cooked wild rice, and 1/4 cup of chopped parsley. Now, I know this sounds like a lot of ingredients, but basically I use what I have in my house. So if you don't have some of these vegetables, substitute other vegetables or use less variety, and it still will be great. You know, things like garlic, ginger, I always have. Nutritional yeast, I always have. Tamari, mirin, I always have. So they're just, you know, opening up my pantry and creating. And when you have a lot of things in your pantry, you really become the artist, and you're like painting with all these different colors and ingredients, and your imagination can just go wild. So that was this dish right here, the stuffed acorn squash. So like I said, I started by cutting the acorn squash in half lengthwise, removing the seeds and cutting off the bottom so the squash can sit flat. Then I brushed the top with olive oil and sprinkled it with a few mixed herbs. And I laid it face up in a casserole pan, poured a little water around the squash to help it cook and steam, and I covered it with aluminum foil. And I roasted it in a 400-degree oven for about 20 minutes. When it was soft, I removed it from the oven, and I just let it cool. While that was cooking, I started the filling. So I started by sautéing the onions in olive oil until they were translucent. Then I added the carrots, the parsnips, and celery. And I cook those for another 5 minutes. Again, always starting with the root vegetables, the vegetables that are hardest and take the longest to cook. After I cooked those for 5 minutes, I added the garlic, ginger, and the Chinese 5-spice. And I let that simmer a little bit. Then I added the broccoli and the cauliflower. Cooked that for a few more minutes and added the sage. Then I added the mirin, the tamari, the nutritional yeast, and water. And I mixed that up into the pan so that I was making a little bit of a sauce. Then I added the peppers, the shiitake mushrooms, and the asparagus. Then the zucchini and the yellow summer squash. And I cooked all of that for about 5 minutes. Then I added the cannellini beans, the almonds, the wild rice, and mixed that all up. At the very end, I added the 1/4 cup of chopped parsley. Again, mixed it up, and I stuffed the acorn squash with that vegetable mixture. And then at that point, you can store it in the refrigerator for a day or two until you're ready to use it. But then when you're ready, you can bake it at 375 for 20 minutes covered, remove it from the oven, and serve it immediately. And it's ready, and it's delicious. It already has the grain in it, so you can just serve it with a big salad. Or if you wanted, you know, to serve it with some roasted potatoes or some quinoa on the side, you certainly can. So now it is my pleasure to introduce to all of you Tim West. Tim is, as I said, is recognized as one of Zagat's 30 under 30, which is their rating for chefs that are under 30 years old, that they really think we need to be watching because they're up to some great things. And Tim West certainly is. He is a chef that has turned social entrepreneur. He started his career after the Culinary Institute of America, where he was the person who brought the first slow food chapter to the Culinary Institute. And he cooked his way from the St. Regis Hotel in New York to the Facebook headquarters in California. And that's where he entered the world of food and technology and really found how to make a marriage with them. He moved to California, and before that he studied sustainable food systems and social movements at the University of Massachusetts. In 2009, he started the UMass Permaculture Project and wrote their climate action plan to achieve carbon neutrality in food. And I'm going to let him tell you more about his latest creation called Food Hackathon. So, Tim, are you with me?
Good morning, Bhavani. You're making me hungry already.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Very well.
Well,
thank you for
waking up so early. I know you're in California right now, so it's 7 o'clock in the morning. So I really appreciate that.
I have my tea in hand, but I really want some squash now.
Well, do it. It's a great recipe. It's on my website, and it'll be posted on the PRN website later today. So you can certainly create it. So anyway, I want to know just a little bit about your history, if you could share some of that with my listeners before we get into the, I want to say the meat and potatoes of what you're doing now, but let's come up with another term. But anyway, when and how did you realize you wanted to be a chef? Was that obvious to you as a child, or how did that happen?
My brother and I have an identical twin brother. In fact, I'm a triplet. We grew up in the suburbs of New York, and I had always cooked in food, and I had worked in food, scooping ice cream when I was a little kid. And my brother had decided, you know, after high school, he was going to the Culinary Institute of America, but I decided that, you know, I wanted my own identity. So I went to the University of Colorado in Boulder. And it wasn't until I was in Boulder that I had what I call my first food epiphany. And by food epiphany, I mean food poisoning. I'd been eating from some fast food restaurants out there. And after about 3 days of thinking I was going to die, I called my twin brother Chris and I said, "Chris, I really need to learn how to cook." And he told me how to cook some chicken. So I got a pan hot, I threw some chicken in it. And I was about to sit down to eat. And it was at that moment that I heard a knock on my door. And I opened the door, and it was my neighbors from down the hall, and they had smelled this chicken, and they wanted me to share. And that's when I realized that if I learned to cook, that I'd be healthier, I'd make more friends, and it was really a skill I could travel with. So that's when I decided it was time for me to go to culinary school.
Oh, so you left University of Colorado, went to culinary school, or you went to UMass first?
I started at University of Colorado. I really had no idea what I wanted to do, but I figured it was a big enough school where I had a lot of options. Ultimately, I ended up coming back to the East Coast and transferring to the Culinary Institute of America.
Uh-huh. And when did you discover the slow food movement?
It was in a gastronomy class. Alana Rader was my professor there, and that's the first time I heard the word slow food, and it made a lot of sense to me. And she at that time we were trying to rally some students to work on this club. We were calling it the Chef Sustaining Agriculture Club, and it was a really cool group of people that were, you know, educating themselves and about, you know, slow food and local agriculture. And we had a ball with it, except a lot of students weren't showing up to it. So I started thinking to myself, it's like, where are they? Why aren't they coming to these farm tours? And I realized, and this is one of my best realizations, I realized they were drinking beer. So instead of trying to pull them out the farms, I decided to meet them where they were. And we decided to do an organic local beer event with Brewery Oma Gang. To coincide with the launch of their beer, Three Philosophers, we brought in three philosophers to lecture on beer, food, and culture. And that was, I think, one of the most successful events that I've seen students put together at CIA. And that really kicked off what began the slow food chapter at CIA.
It's funny that you say that because one of our most successful events for Slow Food Huntington, where I am the co-chair, was also a beer event. It was sold out. It was the first really public slow food event that Slow Food Huntington ever did, and it also was a great success. People love beer. What can we say?
They sure do.
Beer is great.
Indeed.
And with the whole local beer movement, you know, you have breweries going on everywhere, and it's really exciting.
Oh, it sure is.
So, so you went from the Culinary Institute. When were you at UMass? After that?
So after CIA, my brother and I ended up in New York. We started this edible education project teaching kids and seniors with dementia cooking and farming classes. I also was cooking at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan doing banquets, and ended up leaving New York, heading out to Slow Food Nation in 2008 in San Francisco, which was a really great gathering. About 80,000 people culminated in San Francisco for the end of Carla Bertrini, the founder of the Slow Food Movement's World Book Tour. And from there, my brother and I were invited to represent the U.S. at Terra Madre, Slow Food's World Meeting of the Food Communities, in October 2008 in Torino, Italy. And that's really where I discovered that, you know, there's people all around the world that are like me, that are as dedicated as I am. So I kind of vowed to myself to come back to the United States and instigate food revolution. And at that time, I had a girlfriend at the university, or she was at Mount Holyoke, so I discovered the five college system and ultimately UMass Amherst, where there was a young sustainable food systems degree. UMass Dining is the second largest self-operated food service in the country, doing 40,000 meals a day. And that piqued my interest, so I dove right in, you know, especially because they were the land-grant university of Massachusetts, or one of them, I think MIT is the other. And that, to me, I thought was the best point of leverage to come back and really instigate some type of food revolution.
So that's really interesting. So you went from Colorado to CIA to UMass. And that's where you got your degree. Did you get a degree from there, another degree?
I ended up studying for about a year and a half there, got involved, organized to write the Climate Action Plan. That, out of that was born the UMass Permaculture Project. And I was loving my life. I was about two semesters away from graduating when I got a phone call. And that phone call came from the executive chef at Facebook, who had heard about me and my brother and my work, and he invited me out to California to audition for a job to open the second cafe at their headquarters. So without graduating, I took a leap of faith in a downturn economy to go join what I thought was the most innovative company in the world and moved out to California to work in food at Facebook.
Wow, and how long did you do that?
I spent almost a year at Facebook. Really, you know, just in awe of the amazing culture that had been created, and in the opportunity that existed within technology. We were running, or we were cooking for these hackathons at Facebook, and a hackathon is a marathon of hacking, of creating, of birthing, of prototyping, and they were taking their employees and overnight, They would work all night long and come up with new ideas for new products and then launch new products to this company. So it was really a positive form of the word hacking, of creating. And I was feeding them. And you know, this is where all of the creative, you know, creativity and innovation was coming from. So that's when I decided to really dive into that world of technology and left Facebook to start my first food tech company.
And what was the food tech company called?
The first one was called Grubly. It was kind of a take on Airbnb. It was like an Airbnb for food, doing underground dinners, pop-up restaurants, but really taking underutilized spaces like your kitchen table or your dining room table and trying to bring people together around food. In my mind, it was really trying to address this challenge of, you know, 80% of restaurants fail within the first 2 years. So how is it that we can actually give food entrepreneurs more resources, more skills, more money more feedback from the community so that they have a higher chance of success. And also just bringing people together so that they can enjoy food. We ran that for about a year before having founder issues and ended up all going to Burning Man, you know, as you do here in San Francisco. And that's when, you know, more opportunities started arising for me. I ended up actually being invited to participate in my first hackathon. It was called the Startup Bus. So it was 150 entrepreneurs on buses, 11 different buses from all around the country, including Mexico, 3 days hacking, you know, in this kind of business plan competition style, on the way to Austin for South by Southwest. And it was on that bus that we came up with this really silly idea for a custom cereal company. And this was a total joke. I just needed a ride to Austin to throw a party for Shareable, Share Austin. And lo and behold, you know, by the time we had gotten to Austin, we were having so much fun. We had actually ordered boxes and printers and cereal, and we made Cinnamon Tech Crunch and Robert Scoble's Scobalize and Apple Jacks and all these little fake boxes of cereal, and we're giving them out so much to the point where when we got into the finals, I actually went up to the judges, and I handed them all bowl spoons and milk, and I said, you know, these are our, you know, our products. This is our entry vector to the mass customized food market. You know, we're sold out. And Dave McClure, who's this foul-mouthed venture capitalist, you know, I had this box of effing flakes, and I said, Dave, these are the last effing flakes in Austin. We're sold out. And he broke out $10, and he says, you know, here's your first effing sale. The next judge said, you know, this is possibly the stupidest idea I've ever heard, and it's probably going to make $1 billion. So long story short, we, like, accidentally won this huge startup competition. And again, that's where I started to really, truly understand the power of technology to help transform our food system. So I dove in even further.
Uh-huh. And how did you use technology to introduce Cerealize? Like, how did that technology help that?
I bought Cerealize.com, Cerealize.com. You know, we were joking, we were serial entrepreneurs of the sea, and, you know, that's kind of how it was born, and we made this silly little website where you can click on, you know, adding ingredients to your bowl. So it could be, you know, cornflakes with nuts and fruit and bacon. And the bowl would spin around and you know, you would share it on social media, and that was our marketing play.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a silly little website that came together, but then spread all of this kind of through Facebook and the social network channels. And again, that's how I really discovered how to use social media properly.
Right. And so now you launched your own food hackathon. When did
you
do that?
You know, as I was, you know, attempting these different food businesses, I realized that there really isn't a lot of resources available to help food entrepreneurs. So I decided with a couple of buddies of mine to start this first ever kind of food hackathon, you know, a business plan competition for food startups. But more than anything else, in my mind, it's really meant to build this ecosystem of mentorship, of investors, of entrepreneurs, in a culture of sharing ideas, of supporting each other. And we launched the first food hackathon in April of 2013. We had about 250 people come in from 5 different countries, which I thought was amazing. And then we launched the second one. We called it the Future of Food Hackathon back in November of last year. We had 350 people come in from 15 countries.
Wow.
And it just built up this unbelievable community of people. And I realized that, you know, I wasn't creating this energy. I was just giving it an outlet to release. So for us, it's just about creating the platform that allows everybody to do what they already want to be doing and what they're already doing, just doing it better and faster and having more fun at it.
Right. Yeah, it's always more fun when you're working together in a group and you are collaborating, you know, and the, you know, I love the idea of staying up all night and brainstorming. And so is that the format that you guys use? Is it an all day, all night type of thing, or how does it work?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that the typical hackathon culture here in San Francisco involves a lot of Red Bull and cheap pizza. So the people would literally stay up all night long, you know, trying to code and build And when I saw that, I thought to myself, well, what if we were to really infuse these brilliant engineers and designers and hackers with brain foods, with salad, with chocolate, with Amazon energy drinks? So for us, it became not just, you know, an outlet for creating code, but an opportunity to inoculate these engineers with, you know, healthy foods and just educate them about what's actually possible and how their bodies work. So it became much, much larger than actually just producing code, but actually kind of shifting hacker culture.
Mm-hmm. And where do you see Food Hackathon going in the next 5 years? It's already expanded, right? Didn't you tell me there's one going on this weekend down in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, actually, National Geographic, I'm sure you've seen their latest article is on the future of food. And they're actually doing a future of food hackathon this weekend at their office in D.C. There's also meat hackathons. There's dining hackathons. I'm going next weekend to Bologna, Italy, where there's going to be a food hackathon. So now all of a sudden the meme has just taken off, and people are just replicating the model, which is, in my mind, just a wonderful thing that, you know, these kind of things are happening. So for us and Food Hackathon, we're going to be announcing another event on foodhackathon.com and our new news site, futurefoodtech.com, in the next couple of days, and it's going to be called Back to the Future of Food Hackathon, and I will likely be here in San Francisco.
When's that going to be?
It'll be July 25th, 6th, and 7th, likely.
Of this year?
Right. Of this year, correct, yeah.
You know, that's one thing that's amazing. You know, because I guess you're so connected to social networking that you could actually plan something now for July. You know, usually those kind of things would take years of planning or a year, you know, a year out.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that the first time we did this, we actually did it in 2 weeks, from idea to execution. And that demonstrates the true power of social media and of how excited this world is right now to be hacking food.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, for me, the future of Food Hackathon is in our partnerships and in kind of creating an open source model to allow others to really take this to the world. We've been really fortunate to team up with the Institute for the Future. They're a great think tank here in Palo Alto. In fact, I think today they're announcing their 10-year forecast, which is really exciting. And we're looking at doing an ethnographic study with them to see kind of what the ripple effects are there and trying to measure some of the outcomes. I'm also really looking forward to trying to bring this back to my alma mater, the Culinary Institute of America, and help encourage more entrepreneurship through CIA and other schools. Be that UMass Amherst or whoever. So, I mean, at this point, you know, we just have such a good time following up on the inbound interest of people that really want to get involved and support. Right now we're looking for space in San Francisco that can actually hold, you know, the amount of people that are showing up. So, you know, it's really exciting to be here because in Silicon Valley, all of these tech companies have so many really wonderful resources that they're allowing the community to utilize to really improve the community. You know, Airbnb's food service program is phenomenal, and they're really looking to give back to the community. You know,
can you say that again? Airbnb actually has a food service now, or no?
So it's funny because when Airbnb first started growing, actually the cereal idea I got from them because
Backtrack just a moment and tell people who are listening what Airbnb is, because I'm not sure everyone knows.
Sure. Cool. Well, Airbnb started when there was a conference in town and there was no more hotels left. Some friends of mine ended up kind of putting up together a website that allowed people to rent their airbeds, their blow-up beds. And, you know, that's kind of how it began, was trying to say, like, hey, I've got a room, I've got a blow-up bed, it's next to this convention center, and you could use it instead of going to a hotel because they're all sold out. So it actually began a movement in the sharing economy, kind of building off of the energy that couch surfing was, of traveling the world on people's couches, and just connecting people so that they can share their resources, make a little bit of money, make some new friends, maybe eat some food together.
Uh-huh.
And You know, that company has grown tremendously. They raised $112 million 2 years ago based on a $1 billion valuation after running the company for 3 years. So really tremendously explosive growth that has, in a lot of ways, disrupted a stagnant industry, the hotel industry.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Airbnb, the company itself, has understood that food is a really important part of the culture. In fact, Sam Lipman, who's their executive chef, I met at a farmer's market. He became a Grubly chef of mine. And when Airbnb asked me if I knew any raw food chefs, because they were moving into an office and they didn't have a kitchen and they didn't have a lot of money, I introduced him to Sam. And Sam has now grown, in my mind, what is the most progressive, delicious, healthy food service program in any company culture that I've seen so far.
And where is he doing that?
It's right here in San Francisco. At 8th and Brannan. And they just have a wonderful office, lots of natural light, and serve the most delicious, you know, raw foods, cooked foods, local foods, and I have a great culture.
Wonderful. So now that you told us what Airbnb is, I want to hear more about, you know, how the food intertwines with that. But first, before you do that, let's take a couple-minute break, mm-hmm. and when we come back, tell us about that, okay? Everyone listening, you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest is Tim West, a social food entrepreneur. Be right back with all of you. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Mm-hmm. And my guest today is Tim West, a slow food chef from California turned social entrepreneur and the founder of a wonderful food tank think-a-thon called Food Hackathon. Tim, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, so you were just sharing with us what Airbnb is, and now how does that relate to food? What were you calling it with food? Food B&B?
What are you talking about, Grubly?
No, we were talking about Airbnb and then how it was relating to food.
I think they were just, I was just mentioning that they're opening a lot of resources for food entrepreneurs and supporting food entrepreneurs right now, which is really neat. And it's just one example of how some of these tech companies, which are getting a bad rap because of the Google buses and so forth, are actually doing a lot of good and deserve a lot of credit because they're supporting a lot of food entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. So Airbnb is just one of them right now.
Uh-huh. And are there a lot of pop-ups that are using social media to kind of get that going in the California area? I know we have some of that going on in New York for sure.
I think businesses in general, I've really understood how powerful social media is as a very cheap form of marketing. And food entrepreneurs are, of course, tapped into it because they need to be. It's a way for them to build community, to really be in touch personally with their followers and their customers. So, I mean, for me, social media is just ingrained into the future of business.
Mm-hmm. You were sharing with me recently that you were down in Washington, D.C., you know, and that you were the one that told me that they had a new beehive down in Washington.
Yeah,
Can you tell us what you were doing down there and how food brings you down to the D.C. area?
Yeah, absolutely. I have these friends in New York, Mickey and Radha Agarwal, these two amazing identical twins, and they have worked on a couple of different food businesses together. They have a gluten-free pizza restaurant in Manhattan and Williamsburg called Wild, really amazing pizza. And they also have launched something called Super Sprouts, S-P-R-O-W-T.
Yeah, Radha was on my show years ago.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, Radha very brilliantly kind of created a bunch of characters similar to Sesame Street characters, but these characters are vegetables. It's Colby Carrot and Erica Eggplant and Susie Sweet Pea. And all of these sprouts, as they're called, have superpowers. So Colby Carrot's superpower is super sight. And Erica Eggplant is super smart, and it's encouraging kids to eat their superpowers, which to me is just brilliant. You're using
it is, and they have the greatest books that go along with these characters. So, I've shared those books with some of my little nursery school classes that I do little food demos in. They are great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm such a big fan, and so is Sam Kass, the White House chef. So he invited the Super Sprouts to the Easter egg roll last Monday at the White House, and we got to go around the White House lawn introducing kids and families to the Super Sprouts, and then did a cooking demonstration with Sam Kass on stage. And that's when we got to learn about the bees. And the funny backstory behind the bees is Sam Kass was originally not allowed to have the bees at the White House. He was told no. So he conspired with a guy who's done laundry there for 40 years, and they actually snuck the beehive into the White House in the laundry and then put it out on the lawn and said, well, we have bees now. We got to keep them. And they just built a new 1,100-foot pollinator bed in the garden, which is really amazing, so that bees have habitat on the White House lawn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I did that here as well on my property. We put in a whole pollinator garden for our bees. And, it's wonderful. We have two beehives. It's our second year. Well, actually, we're going into our second season, so they made it through their first winter here. And they're both really strong hives. It's really very exciting.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think that the Super Sprouts have such an amazing potential to really affect kids, which to me are the root of the issue. The root of the issue here in our food movement is that kids are not educated about food. I was not educated about food. My parents weren't educated about food. So I feel like if we can use these amazing media tools for good, with the Super Sprouts, I actually heard that Disney just licensed their characters to the Produce Buyers Association, I believe, so that we're going to start to see Disney characters promoting vegetables. You know, if we can start to really get to the root of the issue, which is kids, we're going to start to have some really huge positive change in the next few years. And
that would
I think
be
the White
so
House
great.
Garden,
I mean, school food and educating kids is really my passion. I know you know that. I mean, I just feel like the reason I got into food was to feed my children really well, and then it just grew from there when I saw what, you know, they were serving in the public school, and, you know, and I was horrified, and, you know, I've been working to try to improve that, and, you know, the demos I do to PTAs, you know, to try to introduce moms and parents to healthy cooking. It's so foreign to so many people, even today with all this news media. So the more that we can do it, and I think a lot is really starting with the kids from early on. You know, I was reading this piece that Mark Bittman wrote, you know, can you imagine if, when kids start school, if their school lunch starts with beans and rice and an apple for dessert, and that's what they come to expect. But if you give them, you know, pizza on one day and chicken nuggets the next day, and then the third day beans and rice, well, you know, they want the pizza and the chicken nuggets. So you got to you got to start them off with good food, and then that's what they'll expect is the norm. And you know, another thing that I learned is that you don't ask kids what they want to eat. You say, this is what's for dinner. And as the parent, you kind of, you know, dictate the food that's healthy for them that you want them to eat. You don't really give them the choice.
I think there needs to be some tricks involved as well. You know, when I taught my cooking classes, if the kids had a hand in making dinner, all of a sudden they wanted to eat it because they created it. You know, and if we made it fun, if, you know, I said to them, you know, do you want to eat soybeans? They said, no. I said, well, if you eat soybeans, you're going to be a soybean superhero. Boom, they're eating handfuls of soybeans. So it really has to be fun along the way as well.
Right.
And I was just down at the Food Innovator Awards in D.C. a couple of weeks ago, and one of the statistics I remember is that, you know, the United States is the wealthiest nation on this planet. But are we the healthiest nation on this planet? We're not the healthiest nation.
No.
We are not the second healthiest. We are the 40th. I mean,
that's
amazing. To me is stunning.
Right.
So, I mean,
that really demonstrates that, you know, we need to get to the root of this issue, and I think we are. I think that's, you know, I love this show, and I think that there's a lot of really interesting things happening right now. I see this guy, Lawrence Williams. He's incredible. He's a guy that worked with Elon Musk, you know, founder of Tesla and founder of SpaceX. He worked on SpaceX, and he went in to the aerospace industry and really kind of knocked them around. And he left that to start the United States Healthful Food Council. It's modeled after the United States Green Building Council. And they do the LEED certification for homes is what the building council does. But Lawrence has created real certification for food. And it's about sustainability. It's about health. There's a whole bunch of different metrics that they use. And again, I think this is just one of those kind of overarching platforms that's going to help encourage businesses to be real certified. And I think once that starts to happen, we're going to start to have this kind of tipping point where it becomes standard that you're real certified. It becomes standard that you're organic. And that's the direction that we're fortunately headed in.
But do you trust, once something becomes a, you know, a U.S. A U.S. organization, it gets infiltrated by, you know, big business, the Walmarts that are, you know, doing organic now, and the, you know, Grocery Manufacturers Association, and then, you know, the Monsanto people, and, you know, they all get infiltrated, and you can't trust them. Mm-hmm. You know, I was talking about the organic standard, the National Organic Standards Board, and mm-hmm. that's completely corrupt now. There's, you know, the Monsanto guys are running the show there, you know, and the Monsanto guys are running the FDA and the USDA. I mean, it's like they infiltrate everywhere, and, you know, how do you keep something pure that, you know, starts out? I mean, I think most entrepreneurs who started some sort of organic company had an altruistic purpose, and and then they sell out, you know, and you can't blame them when they're being offered, you know, $1 billion or however many millions of dollars to sell to these big companies, but then they get bought out. I mean, you know, when Silk Tofu was all organic, and now Silk Tofu says natural on it, it's no longer organic. And, you know, and tofu's made from soybeans, and, you know, 90% of the soybeans are genetically modified in this country. So it becomes a really hard thing. How do you feel confident that it will stay pure?
Let me first start by sharing one of my favorite quotes as of right now. It is that the United States will always do what is right after exhausting every other option. And I think we're at that point. We have no other option left but to improve our food system. Getting back to your, you know, your concerns about kind of the later on corruption in business, I think that's, again, the root of the issue is in how it's funded and how it's founded. When you have companies that are taking, you're making huge bets like these venture capital companies are doing, and they make so many bad bets that they have to milk the good ones for every penny, that's when you get those problems later where you're moving away from your mission. When you go public, you know, public companies are legally responsible to their bottom line above all else. That means above your health, above the environmental health. So how do we start companies that don't have those problems further down the line? B corporations, or for benefit corporations, are a type of structure where legally the founders of the company, the board of the company, is responsible to the mission and the charter above the profit. Profits are important. Profits are an incredibly powerful source of growing business. I think, you know, for-profit companies are going to change the world, but it can't do it at the expense of our health any longer and at the expense of our planet. So I think really getting to the root of those structures, and again, this is why, for me, Food Hackathon is so important, is we're educating these food entrepreneurs about how to start businesses that will ultimately grow into healthy, thriving businesses that support them, support their communities, and produce a really good product that plugs into an ecosystem that's shifting our entire food system towards something that's good, clean, and fair, the way Slow Food, you know, describes.
From your mouth to God's ears. Sounds great. And how do you stay so optimistic?
Well, good food, good friends. You know, there's no other option in my mind. We have to change, and I'm here. I feel like I've educated myself about the challenges, and, you know, a lot of them can be really frustrating. But, you know, the frustration doesn't help me. If I just stay focused on what I can actually do every single day, how I can spend my money, how I can spend my time, I all of a sudden start to attract other people that care as much as I do. And now we have safety in numbers. We have strength in numbers. And I lead an incredible life because I've just, you know, completely given myself to this cause. And I see people all the time that are as passionate and dedicated as I am, just as you are. And, you know, that gives me hope. That fuels my fire. That feeds my soul.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. So how can people get involved? What do you recommend?
I mean, I always like to say that the first most important thing you can do is, you know, you have three opportunities a day, likely, to vote with your fork, you know, spend your money locally, vote with your wallet, and that's the easiest, best thing we can do, because you also get to make friends along the way, and, you know, get involved with what I'm doing. You can visit our websites, foodhackathon.com and futurefoodtech.com. You can follow me at tim.chris.com. You know, find me on Facebook at facebook.com/tim.chris or Twitter, you know, at Timmy West. And, you know, I just love to kind of be the megaphone that shares a lot of what the opportunities are to go out, that are happening out there. And you know, get involved with your local slow food chapter. You know, just continue listening to radio shows like this. But you know, get involved in schools and changing school food, you know, march with against Monsanto, you know, just educate yourself. But the most important piece is have a lot of fun while you're doing it, because if we're not having fun, nothing's ever going to get changed.
Thank you. That's a beautiful way to end. Everyone, thank you for joining us. Tim, thank you so much for coming on. You can feel your excitement and love of what you're doing. It comes through, it radiates through, and, you know, and hopefully that's what's catching. And the more we can get everybody to, as you said, do something, find some area around food that you can, you know, sink your teeth into and make a difference. And thank you so much for joining us, Tim. Everyone out there.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Everyone out there, have a great, great rest of the week, and I'll see you again next Thursday. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Bye for now.